Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Zeta Talk was considered bizarre in many of its statements in 1995, when Zeta Talk first began, talking about gravity particle flows and matters of astronomy, in other words, science, that conflicted with the standard view humans hold. But as time passes, admissions by NASA and the science community have consistently proven Zeta Talk to be right. Here's a couple of recent examples that have to do with the sun. On August 15, 1995, the Zetas went on record stating that our sun has a binary, and that Planet X orbits both on a long elliptical orbit, essentially a sling orbit. These statements were made in the context of discussions about the sling orbit of Planet X, which was discovered in 1983 by NASA and JPL, out in the direction of the constellation Orion, as reported on a front-page article by the Washington Post, December 31, 1983. And I quote, "Mystery heavenly body discovered. A heavenly body possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical Satellite, the IRAS. When IRAS scientists first saw the mystery body and calculated that it could be as close as 50 billion miles, there was some speculation that it might be moving toward Earth." End of the quote. Then the cover-up began, and all manner of excuses were thrown out to reduce panic in the populace. What would cause a sling orbit, cause Planet X to sling past our sun every few thousand years? For the Zetas, Planet X is orbiting two suns, as our sun is a binary. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Comet Orbit, written August 1995. "The path of Planet X is elliptical, making a long flat circle around its two gravitational masters, your sun and a body you cannot see. Since it rivals the sun in mass, the assumption would be that your astronomers would know about it. However, being dark, they stare past it and think it's space. To use multiples of the distance from your sun to its farthest known orbiting planet, which you call Pluto, this foci is from your sun 18.724 times as far away." End of the quote. On October 15, 1995, the Zetas gave more detail about this dark binary, which has never lit. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Second Foci, written October 1995. "This second foci of Planet X has not been located by your astronomers because it is dark, not lit, and does not happen to block any view your astronomers are particularly interested in. They think it empty space. Unlike the sun, this dark twin never lit. Although comparable in size and mass, its composition was subtly different, and it has no potential for becoming a lit sun under the present conditions in your part of the universe. It has no planets of any size to mention, although is orbited by a lot of trash. Should one wish to search for it, it stands at an angle of 11 degrees off the Earth's orbital plane around the Sun, in the same direction we have given for the approach of Planet X. Not being a luminous body, and not giving off any radiation detectable by human devices, you will be unable to locate it, but this does not mean that it is not there." End of the quote from Zeta Talk. In 1995, the scientific community was publicly ridiculing such statements, astronomers silent. But on April 24, 2006, scientists were coming forward declaring that our sun was indeed part of a binary twin set, based on the orbits of newly discovered planetoids, Sedna and Zeta, also known as 2003 UB313. And I quote from a Caltech website on Sedna. On March 15, 2004, astronomers from Caltech, Gemini Observatory, and Yale University announced the discovery of the coldest, most distant object known to orbit the Sun. The object was found at a distance 90 times greater than from the Sun to the Earth, about three times further than Pluto, the most distant known planet. Even more interesting, the orbit of Sedna is extremely elliptical, in contrast to all of the much closer planets, and it takes 10,500 years to circle the Sun. End of the quote from Caltech. Please note that 10,500 is pretty close to exactly three times 3,600 years, the orbit of planet X. And I quote from Caltech on Zeta, also known as 2003 UB313. The new planet is the most distant object ever seen in orbit around the Sun, even more distant than Sedna, the planetoid discovered almost 2 years ago. It's almost 10 billion miles from the Sun and more than three times more distant than the closest planet, Pluto. End of the quote from Caltech. Like the outer planets in the solar system and 13 long-period comets, these long elliptical orbits lean in the direction of Orion, where the Zeta state, the dark binary twin Sun, lies. And I quote from the news article dated April 24, 2006. Evidence mounts for Sun's companion star. The Binary Research Institute, BRI, has found that orbital characteristics of the recently discovered planetoid Sedna demonstrate the possibility that our Sun might be part of a binary star system. A binary star system consists of two stars gravitationally bound orbiting a common center of mass. Most of the evidence has been statistical rather than physical. The recent discovery of Sedna, a small planet-like object first detected by Caltech astronomer Dr. Michael Brown, provides what could be indirect physical evidence of a solar companion. Sedna moves in resonance with previously published orbital data for a hypothetical companion star. In the May 2006 issue of Discover, Dr. Brown stated, "Sedna shouldn't be there. There's no way to put Sedna where it is. It never comes close enough to be affected by the Sun, but it never goes far enough away from the Sun to be affected by other stars. In a very elliptical orbit like that, it simply can't be there. There's no possible way except it is. So how then?" With Dr. Brown's recent discoveries of Sedna and Zeta, now confirmed to be larger than Pluto, the search for a companion star may be gaining momentum. End of the quote. So were the Zetas right about our Sun having a binary? Hey, Zetas right again, big time. During the entry of Planet X into our inner solar system in 2003, there was a notable increase in brightness from the Sun. People reported being sunburned more readily, not being able to look at the Sun as it rose and set as they had been used to doing. On December 11, 2005, the Zetas confirmed sunscald since 2003, scattered white light from the Sun causing sunburn and early crops and a white Sun, all due to the dispersing of light through the tail of Planet X, which had arrived in 2003. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Sunscald, written December 2005. An ultra-glaring sun was noted in 2003 when Planet X roared into the inner solar system from the direction of Orion and screeched to a halt as it neared the sun and the repulsion force clicked in. The tail of Planet X, not affected by the repulsion force, maintained its momentum and wafted past the sun to deliver red dust and odd atmospheric changes to the Earth. In the summer of 2003, it was noted that people sunburned more readily. Construction workers, long used to working out of doors, noted an unusual tendency to burn. Crops likewise matured 2 weeks early that year in many places, and comments about the intense brightness of the sun were common. What causes the sun's scald? The intense brightness that does not translate into increased heat and cannot be correlated to solar activity or sunspots. A fog bank with a light shown on it appears to be evenly lit because the light is scattered and bouncing back to the observer. Is there more light or simply scattered light? If the sun is no longer yellow, it is because all light rays are scattered and the steady state of yellow is interfered with. You formerly looked at the setting sun without distress, the yellow or orange sun, though the sun was still in view and its rays were coming into your eyes with full force. It's the loss of your yellow sun that is affecting your eyes' ability to look at your sun, thus the perception of increased brightness, as the sun's rays, scattered, are presenting the same mix to your eye that high noon presents. Likewise, with the rays that create sunburn, which normally are not bent toward the observer at sunset or other than at high noon, but are now scattered to arrive at one's skin. The time of day is no longer a protection from sunburn. This will only get worse as the tail continues to turn toward the Earth. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. No confirmation of sunscald occurred in the media, and on internet message boards this talk was ridiculed by the professional debunkers. The subject was ignored in the media until 2006, when an official explanation was finally concocted. Basically, where sunlight dimmed by 6% between 1960 and 1990, this trend has now reversed, was the word. No explanation for the reversal was given, except to imply that a reduction in pollutants in the atmosphere was responsible for the dimming. And I quote from the March 26, 2006 article from Times Online in the UK, "Brighter sun adds to fear of climate change. The amount of sunshine reaching Earth is increasing, accelerating the pace of climate change, scientists have found. Researchers will present their findings to the European Geophysical Union Conference in Vienna next week. They reverse a 30-year trend. Measurements of sunrise levels between 1960 and 1990 had shown a decrease in the amount of sunshine reaching the Earth, a phenomenon known as global dimming. This was thought to have been caused by dust, smog, and other pollutants, mainly from industrialized Western countries. The pollutants, known as aerosols, reduced sunshine levels by absorbing and scattering solar radiation and promoting the formation of clouds that reflect radiation back into space. Sunshine levels had been decreasing by 2% a decade between 1960 and 1980, a total decline of about 6%. Now they're going up again. Perhaps this is why our Swiss glaciers are melting." The Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich has collated measurements from 400 sites worldwide and found an increase in sunshine at 300 of them, cited mainly in Eurasia and the polar regions. Some showed a decline in sunshine since 1990, largely in fast-developing countries such as China and India. End of the quote. So this is the reason our poles are melting and the glaciers are melting. People are sunburning more readily and can no longer look at the setting sun because a trend is reversing. Were the Zetas right about sunscald? Hey, Zeta's right again. The Zetas have repeatedly warned mankind to be wary of becoming enslaved during the troubled times leading into the pole shift. Here's some examples. And I quote from Zeta Talk, written October 26, 2002. Governments will be heard from after tragedies, disasters, and when bad news must be announced and can no longer be denied or suppressed. They will be announced solutions, work camps, or refugee camps. And again on February 15, 2003. Another plan was to create work camps to transfer strong workers there with job offers, and we have warned against this early on. And yet again on April 12, 2006. The point of this? To have a worker base, a slave labor base, that is young and healthy and unlikely to complain. Early plans for a draft during the days going into the Iraq War called for men and women 18 to 35 with many skills. This was to be a worker base, not a soldier base. Selecting out this base into camps, along with healthy and compliant unskilled workers from Mexico, would form the slave camps of the future. End of the quotes from Zeta Talk. Have we any sign of such plans? Yes, indeed. On April 27, 2006, the news reported that Halliburton had received a no-bid contract to develop such camps on military bases. And I quote from Jim Hightower's site, an article dated April 27, 2006. Who is to be detained? Halliburton has been granted a $385 million contract for a most unusual project, building a network of detention centers across our country. Up to 5,000 people could be detained and held at each of these centers, which are to be run by Homeland Security authorities and possibly located on unused military bases. So why does America suddenly need to spend a third of $1 billion to establish a new mass prison complex in our country? The feds and Halliburton cryptically say that the detention centers would be needed for some kind of mass migration or for the rapid deployment of new programs. When asked what is meant by the ominous term, new programs, a Halliburton spokeswoman said she could provide no additional information. Another curious aspect is that the Bushites refer to this as a contingency contract, saying that the detention centers might never be built, but that Halliburton will have the cash and authority to move quickly if and when given the go-ahead. But who is to be managed, and in support of what policy? And most particularly, who is to be detained? End of the quote. Well, does it look like the Bush administration is planning slave labor camps or work camps, detentions? What can I say? Zeta's right again. Zeta Talk has also mentioned the tendency of people to migrate when things get bad where they live, not only after the pole shift when things are bad everywhere, but prior to the shift as the earth changes bring economic depression. For instance, in April 1999, Zeta Talk stated in their 1999 predictions that migrations would increasingly occur as people tried to find refuge, someplace, as the cataclysms approached. And I quote from Zeta Talk, 1999 predictions, written April 1999. You will find human populations beginning to migrate. These migrations not only happen in cases of severe starvation, such as northern Africa, south of the Sudan, where people just stumble like sticks in any direction looking for food, but also occur when things get bad enough, when crop shortages are bad, and people begin to wander. They're looking for something better, so you have these migrations and you have guards against migrations, rifles at the border, pointing and saying, "Don't come a step further," and shooting people for little reason. This is already starting to raise its head in the anxiety that the United States expresses about the people south of its borders. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. And again in September 1999, Zeta Talk stated, "We have predicted that people will begin to migrate. If things are untenable where they are, they will roam or try to, and there will be increased blocking at the borders. Likewise, job instability will occur." End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Increased migrations were reported by the year 2000 around the world, but by 2006 the U.S. was having a real immigration crisis. And I quote from Capitol Hill Blue, an article dated March 29, 2006. flood of illegals turns into a tsunami. Senator Lindsey Graham hears about illegal immigration wherever he travels his home state of South Carolina. And for good reason. South Carolina, a state with historically few illegal immigrants, saw a 1,000% increase in their numbers from 1990 to 2004. With 55,000 undocumented residents, South Carolina ranks far behind the nation's leader, California. But the issue is boiling through the country as illegal immigrants make their way to more cities and states than ever. End of the quote. The statistics, graphed on a chart, show that in 1996 there was an estimated 5 million illegals in the U.S. By the time Bush took office, a mere 4 years later, this had increased to 8.4 million, and by March 2005 to 11 million. An explosion. There are estimates now there may be perhaps 20 million illegals in the U.S., primarily Mexicans. So were the Zetas right when they said migrations would increase as the times got tight? Hey, once again, Zetas right again. When the Zetas first predicted satellite problems, they were ridiculed, as all seemed well at the time. This was in August 1996, Zeta Talk stating that satellites will begin pointing in wrong directions, causing them to misperform. And I quote from Zeta Talk, "As Planet X approaches and magnetic confusion increases, these satellites will begin to misperform. Satellites use magnets for alignment of their internal mechanisms, and if pointing in wrong directions, communications are halted." End of the quote from Zeta Talk. But then in May 1998, a massive satellite failure occurred because a satellite rolled out of position. And I quote, "Satellite failure causes communications chaos." On Tuesday, May 19, 1998, at 6 p.m., the satellite Galaxy 4 suffered a failure in its onboard control system. The backup switch also failed, and the 250 million satellite rotated out of position, completely disrupting communications here on Earth. Galaxy 4 was launched in June 1993. It's positioned in a geosynchronous orbit, 22,000 miles above Kansas. USA Today called the incident the biggest telecommunications failure in recent years, adding that the breakdown wiped out pager traffic, halted credit card transactions, and knocked TV and radio stations off the air. Galaxy 4 remains in orbit but is no longer pointing at its target on Earth. An onboard navigational computer and its backup failed. No one knows why Galaxy 4's spin controller and backup failed. End of the quote. During the January 16, 2002 live Zeta Talk sessions, the Zetas added detail to their predictions, and I quote from this live Zeta Talk, "We've predicted the satellites will malfunction in the years before the shift. Satellites have already been misbehaving by early 2002, but the public is not informed anymore as they were in 1999 or thereabouts. More satellites are put up, a backup system in place, and the functions overlap at all times. Since the military and a few telecom companies are doing this, the public is kept in the dark. Few know the number of satellites and their functions and ownership." End of the quote from Zeta Talk. On July 11, 2002, SpaceSmart reported not only that the failure rate was up 146% and their numbers doubled between 1996 and 2002, GPS failures were also reported. So where are we today? Anticipating more failures as Planet X steadily looms closer and the charged tail of Planet X begins pointing toward the Earth, the establishment had to come up with some excuse. By May 4, 2006, in the middle of the solar minimum, severe warnings were being issued. But you will note, the Sun, not Planet X, is being blamed Nevertheless, the satellite failures predicted by the Zetas are occurring, and we're being warned about even more to come. And we're being warned about even more to come. And I quote from the article dated May 4th, 2006, Scientists Warn of Immense Solar Storm Threat. As the world scrambles to prepare for hurricanes and earthquakes of unprecedented strength, some scientists say the sun poses an equal threat, with predictions calling for a 2012 sunstorm of immense proportions. The vast space between the Earth and the Sun is filled with electrically charged particles, radiation, magnetic fields, and electromagnetic energy that could play havoc with Earth in the event of elevated solar output. The last great solar superstorm was 145 years ago, but this event provides little context given our very recently adopted dependence on satellite-based technologies. Last month, experts convened in Colorado during Space Weather Week to discuss the issues surrounding the approaching 2012 event. If the storm turns out to be the same scale as the one in 1859, economic disaster would ensue, with immediate costs around $20 billion. Sten Odenwall, based at NASA's Goddard Space Center in Greenbelt, predicts that the 2012 storm will kill only the oldest of the 300 geosynchronous Earth-orbiting satellites. However, the storm would likely reduce the life of all other satellites by 5 to 10 years. These long-term problems would add tens of billions of dollars over the years. Geosynchronous satellites alone generate about $97 billion U.S. in revenue each year. A solar superstorm could also force about 100 low-lying orbiting spacecraft to undergo earlier than normal re-entry, disrupt global positioning system the world over, and force the International Space Station to lose altitude. End of the quote. So are we worried about satellite failures? What can I say? Zeta's right again, right on target. Another example of a Zeta Talk statement at first decried and ridiculed, and then confirmed, is the Columbia shuttle disaster in 2003. When this occurred, the Zeta stated promptly that the shuttle had been taken down by aliens on instructions from the Council of Worlds. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Columbia, written February 1, 2003. A decision was made by the Council of Worlds and the directive carried out by those visitors who carried their concerns to the Council. Those astronauts who go on missions know the dangers, the shuttle having blown up previously due to a faulty O-ring. Thus, they have made their peace with death, 2-1. The message of the disintegrating and finally exploding shuttle was to the Bush administration, who will not fail to get the message. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. NASA announced it was due to faulty insulation tiles, a matter not considered serious during previous flights, nor considered serious when some tiles were blown off during blastoff, but the only excuse available. Rumors circulated thereafter about an amateur video of Columbia's entry, quickly hidden from public view. But the subject has recently been revisited and analyzed. And I quote from the article from the Thunderbolts website, Columbia Disaster Revisited, dated March 31, 2006. On February 23, 2005, our topic was Space Shuttle Struck by Mega Lightning. The accompanying picture shows the plasma trail of the shuttle Columbia on re-entry, about 63 kilometers above the Earth, and it seems to show an electric discharge striking the shuttle's plasma trail. For anyone knowledgeable on the upper atmosphere, electrical environment of the Earth, the question raised is all too obvious. Could this discharge have caused the disastrous breakup of the shuttle, leading to the death of the 7 astronauts? Shortly after we posted the story, the amateur astronomer who had taken the picture contacted us. He insisted that we remove the photograph, so we did. Now we are returning the image to our published files because it's not in the public interest that the image be ignored or forgotten. The fate of so many uncomfortable images in the space sciences. One might have expected this image to catch the attention of media around the world. But before that could happen, both the camera and the photograph were examined by NASA scientists. Most shocking was the explanation given by experts who analyzed the photograph. They said that the luminous corkscrew trail was an artifact caused by a camera wobble. The explanation left critics aghast. Since the Columbia Trail in the photo is crisp and with no evidence of camera movement. The Columbia Trail brightens precisely at its juncture with the corkscrew trail. The brightening is an electrically predictable occurrence when two plasma channels merge. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Well, it's pretty obvious we have a cover-up going on. Who leaned on the amateur astronomer who took that video? Who leaned on those experts that were to give that ludicrous explanation? Because the tail of the Columbia is a straight line, and that plasma that's joining it wobbles all over the place, you can't have them both in the same frame of a video. And NASA has been nervous about putting up another shuttle ever since. Well, what can I say? Zeta's right again. Anticipating the Earth wobble, which causes high tides and sloshing in the oceans, on January 15, 1997, very early in Zeta Talk, the Zetas predicted monstrous ocean waves swamping ships. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Manifest Clues, written June 15, 1997. Violent wave action that swamps large ocean-going ships and the booms from clapping air caused by underwater plate movement will be lumped in with earthquake activity. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. After the year 2000, such stories were increasingly in the news, but always in the context of freak or rogue waves that had been reported through the centuries. But by March 31, 2006, it was reported that waves of a size breaking all records had been recorded. These waves were not considered freak waves, a rare single wave, but were sustained over a 12-hour period, so were rather wave action. And I quote from the article, dated March 31, 2006, Vessel measures record ocean swell. A British research team has observed some of the biggest sea swells ever measured. A whole series of giant waves hammered into their ships that were so big, according to computer models used to test safety standards for ships and oil rigs, they shouldn't even exist. When the RRS Discovery set out to sea, the crew was expecting stormy weather. Meteorologists had predicted a violent storm, and the scientists, a team from Britain's Naval Oceanography Center, wanted to observe it from up close. What they ended up experiencing went far beyond anything they could have imagined, and could have cost them their lives. Near the island of Rockall, 250 kilometers or 155 miles west of Scotland, enormous waves came racing toward the vessel. When they checked their measuring instruments later, the scientists discovered that the tallest of these monster waves hit nearly 30 meters or 98 feet at wind force 9. And it didn't come alone. We were shaken up with these waves for 12 hours, said the leader of the expedition. Entire sets of ocean waves hammered the ship. After the adrenaline levels of the scientists had fallen somewhat, astonishment spread among the crew. The standard computer programs had predicted stormy weather for February 8, 2000, but not such a tempest. Even more astonishing, the giant waves had not appeared individually, but in a group. Previously, waves of such size were assumed to only appear alone. The Discovery's crew witnessed the largest waves ever measured by a scientific instrument on the open sea, according to an article the scientists have only now published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. with a height of up to 29.1 meters, 95 feet, from trough to crest. The single waves are the highest ever measured. In terms of so-called significant wave height, they established a new record, according to the scientists. 18.5 meters, or 61 feet. Significant wave height is the median height of a wave's upper third. It corresponds roughly to the sea swell that experienced sailors can estimate with the naked eye. More important than the record, however, is how the waves were born. They were not caused by very strong winds. The strongest phase of the storm had already been over for a day when the largest water mass hit the RSS Discovery. End of the quote. Note that it took them almost 6 years to report this. What was the delay? Was there a cover-up going on? I think certainly where the Zetas made their prediction in 1997 and this record was made in the year 2000, this is a big-time example of Zetas right again. Zetas, and only the Zetas, predicted the current weather irregularities in 1995. This included predictions of intractable droughts and deluges, and this showed up early. It also included swings in temperature. I recall in my girlhood that swings of 20 degrees were not all that unusual, but then in the last few years we began seeing swings of 30 degrees within a day or so, and then 50 degrees within a day. On May 4, 2002, the Zetas stressed that these temperature swings would increasingly occur as we approach the polar shift. And I quote from Zeta Talk, 2002 Quickening, written May 11, 2002. Weather irregularities will continue in the manner we have described since 1995, with increasing swings and extremes, and that weather irregularities are smoothed by nature by increased atmospheric activity or ocean currents. Temperature extremes will not occur, rather oscillating extremes, similar to what the world has already experienced, will occur. Sudden shift to cold weather, sudden unseasonably warm weather, and the like. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. On May 5, 2006, the UK gave us an example of just how swingy these swings have become. And I quote, basking in a one-day heat wave. One of the longest and coldest springs in decades gave way to a mini heat wave yesterday as Britain basked in the highest temperatures of the year. Average temperatures across northern, central, and southeast England were an unseasonably high 77 to 79 Fahrenheit, compared with an average temperature for May of 59 to 61 Fahrenheit. The sudden heat came after a protracted and chilly spring. The temperatures caused severe problems on the London Underground. On the District Line, services were cut in half in the evening rush hour as trains slowed to 20 miles per hour to avoid the tracks buckling in the heat. End of the quote. And here in the U.S., we're having a sudden cold spell, snow in mid-May, affecting the Midwest to the Northeast. So were the Zetas right about weather swings, sudden shifts to cold weather, sudden unseasonably warm weather, and the like? I'd have to say, Zetas right again. On March 17, 2006, the Zetas went on record stating that despite the many reasons for the Bush administration to want to invade and control Iran, that military action most likely would not occur, but would stop short of invasion or attack. This, of course, is in the hands of man and thus cannot be predicted with 100% certainty, but they predicted a U.S. military revolt against Bush plans. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Iran Boondoggle, written March 17, 2006. The likely outcome is that the U.S. will threaten and bluster, plant evidence against Iran that the U.S. citizens and the world will not believe, rumble tanks and planes up to the border of Iran, and there the conflict stops. There will certainly be tense moments behind closed doors when the military is asked to take steps that they refuse to take, confrontations that will not come out in the media until later as leaks. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. On April 8, 2006, Seymour Hersh reported that the military was pushing back against Bush on a nuclear option against Iran, many threatening to resign. This revelation by Hersh was a leak from his confidential sources. And I quote from this article, Joint Chiefs opposed to Iran nuke attack, members of Congress gung-ho. A new report by Seymour Hersh finds that senior Bush administration officials are developing plans for a massive attack on Iran, which could include nuclear weapons. Hersh points out that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a panel of the highest-ranking military officials from each branch of the U.S. Armed Services, are strenuously opposed to the plan, so much so that some have threatened to resign if it goes forward. A Pentagon advisor on the War on Terror confirmed that some senior officers and officials were considering resigning over the issue. There are very strong sentiments within the military against brandishing nuclear weapons against other countries, the advisor told me. This goes to the highest levels. If senior Pentagon officials express their opposition to the use of offensive nuclear weapons, then it will never happen. While senior military officials oppose the use of nuclear weapons, Hersh's sources add that the idea has gained support from the Defense Science Board, an advisory panel whose members are selected by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. End of the quote. On May 11, 2006, news reported that the Bush administration was, as the Zetas predicted, making all the sounds of war, rumbling tanks up to the border. And I quote from a Raw Story article titled, U.S. Military Intelligence Officials Raise Concern About Possible Preparations for Iran Strike. Concern is building among the military and the intelligence community that the U.S. may be preparing for a military strike on Iran as military assets in key positions are approaching readiness. According to military and intelligence sources, an airstrike on Iran could be doable in June of this year, with military assets in key positions ready to go and a possible plan already on the table. Two aircraft carriers are already en route to the region, the USS Abraham Lincoln, which recently made a port call in Singapore, and the USS Enterprise, which left Norfolk, Virginia earlier this month, are headed for the Western Pacific and Middle East. The USS Ronald Reagan is already operating in the Gulf. Retired Air Force Colonel and former faculty member at the National War College, Sam Gardner, has heard some military suggestions of a possible air campaign in the near future. The B-2s, the main firepower asset, to be flown on missions directly from the United States. B-52s to be flown in strikes from the UK and Diego Garcias. A large number of cruise missiles would be fired from the carrier support ships. End of the quote. A little early to know the final outcome, but to date, and certainly on the posturing being taken, looks like Zeta's right again. Another ongoing, in-process matter is the decapitation of the Bush administration, making them ineffective and irrelevant. After the 2004 election, stolen by vote fraud, the Zetas predicted on November 3, 2004, that the puppet master would decapitate the Bush administration in punishment for not allowing Kerry to win as he had wanted. Kerry was to bring the U.S. military back under a commander-in-chief, as they were in revolt against Bush. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Diebold Wins, written November 3, 2004. The puppet master is not pleased and will enact revenge, and the puppet master has more cards than can be imagined. The mess Bush has made rests like a turd on the front steps of the White House. The spiral down into an increasingly hostile and resentful populace, a rebelling bureaucracy, and worldwide disgust will only accelerate. The U.S. will find itself without cooperation when reaching out for help to other countries in their endeavors, while the puppet master enacts financial revenge, punishing the U.S. to weaken Bush and Cheney. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. By March 15, 2006, Bush's approval rating had fallen to 33%. Polls indicated that the word most associated with Bush had become incompetent, followed closely by idiot and then liar. And I quote from a March 15, 2006 article, Bush approval falls to 33%. Congress earns rare praise. Dubai ports fallout. In a word, incompetent. President Bush's declining image also is reflected in a single-word description people use to describe their impressions of the president. 3 years ago, positive one-word descriptions of Bush far outnumbered negative ones. But the one-word characterizations have turned decidedly negative since last July. Currently, 48% use a negative word to describe Bush compared with just 28% who use a positive term, and 10% who use neutral language. The single word most frequently associated with George W. Bush today is incompetent, and close behind are two other increasingly mentioned descriptors, idiot and liar. End of the quote. Then another plunge in the polls to 31% approval. Dated May 8, 2006, USA Today reports, Bush approval rating hits new low. President Bush's approval rating has slumped to 31% in a new USA Today Gallup poll, the lowest of his presidency, and a warning sign for Republicans in the November elections. Only four presidents have scored lower approval ratings since the Gallup poll began regularly measuring it in the mid-1940s. Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, and the first, George Bush. End of the quote. A few days later, on May 12th, down to 29%. The recent plunge is attributed to his base leaving him in droves. And I quote, Bush and GOP Congress losing core supporters. Disaffection over spending and immigration have caused conservatives to take flight from President Bush and the Republican Congress at a rapid pace in recent weeks, sending Bush's approval ratings to record lows and presenting a new threat to the GOP's 12-year reign on Capitol Hill, according to White House officials, lawmakers, and new polling data. Bush and Congress have suffered a decline in support from almost every part of the conservative coalition over the past year, a trend that has accelerated with alarming implications for Bush's governing strategy. The Gallup poll organization recorded a 13 percentage point drop in Republican support for Bush in the past couple of weeks. These usually reliable voters are telling pollsters and lawmakers they are fed up with what they see as an out-of-control spending by Washington, and more generally, an abandonment of core conservative principles. There are also significant pockets of conservatives turning on Bush and Congress over their failure to tighten immigration laws, restrict same-sex marriage, and put an end to the Iraq War and the rash of political scandals. End of the quote. So does this look like decapitation is continuing? The House and Senate going to the Democrats in the fall of 2006? And Bush on the ropes? Ineffective and unable to push his agenda at all? Hey, I guess this is Zeta's right again. On January 6, 2006, the Zeta stated that cell-like structures in red rain that had fallen on India after a meteor disintegrated were a precursor to life, the cell which forms prior to DNA, setting up housekeeping inside the cell. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Space Dust Alive, written January 6, 2006. DNA supports the ability of life to replicate itself and carry forward the dictates of biological function. Since man comes late to examining his own beginnings, he cannot determine if DNA arrived before the cell, or the cell was in place before the DNA. The assumption is that DNA came first, links forming in some kind of primordial soup, and the cell developed later as a protective device. Now they know otherwise. The cell body does not dissipate without DNA, as human scientists know. It feeds and continues. The evidence dropped to Earth was encased in an asteroid chunk that protected the molecular composition of those cells from the formerly life-bearing planets in the asteroid belt. Thus they had no reason to die, but as the shape clearly presents, this was a stage of life prior to DNA insertion, the next stage. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. At that time, on January 6, 2006, news reports were skeptical that this was life in any form, despite the similarity to cellular structure on Earth. And I quote from an article, dated January 5, 2006, Skepticism greets claims of possible alien microbes. A paper to appear in a scientific journal claims a strange red rain might have dumped microbes from space onto Earth 4 years ago. At least 50,000 kilograms, or 55 tons, of the particles have fallen in all. People on the streets found their clothes stained by red raindrops. In a few places, the concentration of particles were so great that the rainwater appeared almost like blood. The particles look like one-celled organisms and are about 4 to 10 thousandths of a millimeter wide, somewhat larger than typical bacteria. The particles seem to lack a nucleus, the core DNA-containing compartment that animal and plant cells have. Chemical tests indicate they also lack DNA, the gene-carrying molecule that most types of cells contain. The outer envelope seems to contain an inner capsule, which in some places appears to be detached from the outer wall and form an empty region inside the cell. Further, there appears to be a faintly visible mucus layer present on the outer side of the cell. The major constituents of the red particles are carbon and oxygen. Carbon is a key component of life on Earth. Silicone is most prominent among the minor constituents of the particles. Other elements found were iron, sodium, aluminum, and chlorine. The red rain phenomenon at first started in Kerala after a meteor airburst event, which occurred on the 25th of July, 2001. Alive or dead, the particles have some staying power, if the paper is correct. Even after storage in the original rainwater at room temperature, without any preservative, for about 4 years, no decay or discoloration of the particles could be found. End of the quote. By March 8, 2006, confirmation from British scientists had come in that the cells appear to be of extraterrestrial origin. And I quote, Red rain from another planet? On July 25, 2001, red rain fell over Kerala. The unusual phenomenon continued for 2 months, raining crimson, turning clothes pink, burning leaves on trees. In some places, the rain fell in scarlet sheets. Scientists were shocked, and the government ordered an investigation. Scientists concluded that the rain was red because winds had swept up dust from Arabia and dumped it on Kerala. But Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, a reader in physics at the School of Pure and Applied Physics at the Mahatma Gandhi University in Kottayam, Kerala, was not convinced. He diligently gathered rain samples and, after months of painstaking research, concluded the red particles which caused the red rain of Kerala are of extraterrestrial origin. His colleagues, other scientists and physicists, frowned at the conclusion. But Dr. Lewis stuck to his theory. His scientific conclusions have now received international support. Dr. Milton Wainwright of the Microbiology Department at the Sheffield University in Britain has been examining some of the particles of the red rain samples that hit Kerala. End of the quote. So were the Zetas right that this is a precursor to life from the meteor and not the excuses thrown up, dust from Arabia and the like? Sure looks like Zeta's right again. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.